says the righteousness of the Tumim, I'll define that in a minute, will straighten his path, and in his wickedness the wicked will fail. Okay? And the question is, what is a Tum? Okay?
Somebody said 11.
A Tum is a person that's evenly keeled. Okay, that's a Tom. He's evenly keeled, but he is not, he has not investigated truth. He's not involved in the world of study, but he is evenly keeled. You could become evenly keeled in one or two ways. Either you're born that way, or you could work it out that you can be evenly keeled. Okay? So they say the righteousness of the evenly keeled person will straighten his path. Okay? By straighten means that it'll protect him and he will not fall, because the opposite is in his wickedness, the wicked will fall. So the thing is that the Tom will not fail. Okay? He will not be broken. Okay? While the wicked will fail in their wickedness. Those are the facts of the verse. Now, the question is that bad things happen to good people. Okay? The book of Proverbs does not deal with outside factors beyond your ability to deal with. That's in your relationship to God. So then you turn to God where you cannot, where you yourself cannot operate, okay? Because it's beyond your ability, it's outside your ability to operate, okay? Something happens, you know what I mean? You're on a bridge and the bridge falls, okay? That's totally out of your domain, okay? Mishlei deals with only what you could do in your situation. In other words, to operate correctly, guides you and trains you to operate correctly in whatever situation you're in. But results are sometimes outside factors which stop you, which you cannot deal with. There's no way that you can deal with that. So therefore, insofar as bad things happen to good people, we're talking about outside their ability. Okay? Also, when you say good people, in America, good people means a nice person, but he has no wisdom, so therefore he could cause his own downfall. In Torah, we deal with wisdom and not good people. But I'm assuming the question is about a good person that has some intelligence. Okay? In other words, the verse is not talking about a righteous person, talking about an evenly keeled person, but not yet involved in the world of wisdom. And the question is, if he's evenly keeled, but he's not yet involved in the world of wisdom, where did he get his righteousness from? Righteousness comes as a result of wisdom. What is the righteousness of the evenly keeled person, despite the fact that he doesn't have knowledge? The question is evenly keeled. Okay, what is evenly keeled? The opposite of evenly keeled is where there's a powerful emotion that's very extreme and draws you. In other words, like this. Evenly keeled person has a certain amount of rebellion, but has a certain amount that he could live in society. Evenly keeled person has a certain amount of anger, but yet he's a certain amount nice. He has both. An extreme person is a person that's constantly angry, always angry. You see, evenly keeled person, he is not pulled by any one emotion to any one extreme. That is the evenly keeled person. Evenly keeled person has, he'll save money, a certain amount to watch his money, but he will spend it. He's not stingy, but he's not a spendthrift. He's not greedy, but he'll make money, he'll put money away, but and he's not lazy. You understand? But he likes to relax. He likes to enjoy life. He is evenly keeled, is that there's no one emotion that draws him to an extreme emotion. Okay? The description that I'm giving, it's correct, Asya, that it is not, has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with your personality. You very rarely find an evenly keeled person. You know what I mean? Like sometimes where a person is extreme, they go to a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and they'll try to lower the area of extreme, try to even them out. You see? So either you're born with that, which is rare, or sometimes you could get professional help in the case where you need it to be able to straighten you out in that way. There are other ways of straightening yourself out. Okay? But however, the thing is that the opposite of an evenly keeled is he has extreme emotions where he pulls very strongly in one direction. In other words, like a person that's evenly keeled has both, he could stand up to fight and defend himself, and he's not meek. But however, there are times when he'll back off from a fight, he feels it's not worth it, you see? But it's all based on a sense of the emotion, not on a training of the mind, where a person through his mind decides what is good and what is evil, where he works out the ideas of good and evil. Okay. The question is that he knows when to back off, and it's only part of his personality. He does have an evaluation of the situation. Okay, he has to evaluate life. I mean, when to take a job, when not to take a job, when to fight a person, when to back off. But however, it's not based on a study, like we sit down and we analyze all the ideas, when to act this way and when to act. It's a training of the mind how to think. He does not have that. The evenly keeled person, the Tom, at the point that he's still a Tom, that he didn't get involved in the world of study, he thinks things out, but however his decisions are based on his emotions. It's not based on a philosophy, like every aspect is worked out like in our life. Like the way we discuss our ideas, every aspect is when to make this decision, when to make that decision, when my emotion is affecting me. Now all these type of discussions, the Tom was not trained in that, but he is evenly keeled. According to this understanding of the verse, then what is the definition of a wicked person? Where you are, a wicked person is a person that's not evenly keeled, and there's an extreme emotion, and that extreme emotion could come about sometimes by birth, and sometimes by a certain lifestyle, there's certain emotions which get worse as you keep allowing that emotion an outlet in your actions, so it keeps getting worse and it affects your personality. In other words, I'll give an example. Let's say, for instance, you're a person that's a pretty happy person, right? Then you're suddenly put in a situation where you're very unhappy. And you react in a negative way, and you start relating, because of that situation, you relate to life in a negative way. Okay? Now, if you continue that for a certain amount of time, that situation can affect your personality, that even where the situation is over, you will continue looking at life in a negative way. You see? So the thing is that sometimes you have an extreme emotion by birth, I wouldn't say birth, I would say the way your parents raised you, and two, You can have extreme emotion by making a certain decision in life or reacting to something in life. When you react to it, so then that could bring out an emotion to an extreme, to being an extreme. Now, a person must make decisions. The only person, let's put it this way, the only person that doesn't make decisions based on his emotions is a thinker. Of course, the thinker thinks things through, and despite his emotions, he won't make a decision insofar as emotions are concerned. But if he's not trained in the world of thought, you see, then basically you must make decisions based on your emotions. Even a person that is trained in thought, powerful emotion will affect the way he makes decisions, you see. So, but at least he has the chance of thinking it through and dealing with it. So the wicked person is where he allows these extreme emotions to make his decisions. And as he acts based on these extreme emotions, his actions are based on it. And therefore, sooner or later, he's going to do wicked or evil acts. The question is, at what point do you become evil? Evil is when you start acting. There's certain acts which we define as evil or wicked. But the cause of the act is the extreme emotion. Having the extreme emotion is not being evil or wicked. Because you can have an extreme emotion and realize that it's wrong and not carry it out, or you might decide to deal with it through study, you see, and go in a different direction. Evil is where you do actions based on these extreme emotions. In other words, when you have a bad emotion, okay, you could deal with it, but then if you carry it out, it affects it, gives strength to the emotion, and the emotion only becomes worse. Okay? Because it develops. Like, for instance, a person steals, right? Now, steal, one of the qualities of steal is I don't recognize you as a human being, or I recognize you as a lower human being. I have the right to take away things from you. Now, the next step is if you get in my way, then I take your life, because I don't think of you. So it's a further development where before I couldn't kill you, but after I trained myself and did actions of taking things from you, which means I think of you not an equal, you don't have the right to ownership, because I have the right to take it away. So then there's a certain point where you start defending yourself, the victim defend themselves, and the criminal kills them, because he holds that the victim doesn't have a right to defend himself. He doesn't have rights. And at a certain point, he will kill him. That is the way emotions, when you act on it, get worse and worse. Okay? The question is, how much knowledge does a person have? What level IQ does a person need to be able to have knowledge, to be able to deal with this type of, to deal with the emotion and the extremes of the emotion, okay? The answer is I can't tell you exactly what level IQ you need. All I can tell you is that Proverbs, or the study of Musar, is the simplest, the least abstract of all the studies that are in Torah. You understand? It's a very, in other words, right. In other words, there are areas of Talmud that you have to be a scientist to really follow. I mean, you have to have a certain level of IQ, and a regular person could not get it. But however, the IQ that is necessary for Musar is a very low level. I mean, there is a point where you can't even understand Musar. To tell you the exact number, I can't tell you. But I can tell you this, that it is a very low number. In other words, most people can understand the world of Musa. Okay?
Yeah. I don't know if I could define exactly what point the change comes where you could understand and where you can't. All I'm telling you is that this study, in other words, I'll give you an example. In Proverbs, it was written by the, according to our sages, the greatest genius that ever lived. He had a greater mind than Moses. Moses was more perfected than Solomon, but Solomon had a more abstract mind. I'll show you areas of math and Talmud that are more abstract than any of the verses that you'll find in Proverbs. You see? Now, how come King Solomon can't write a more abstract book? The answer is he did. He wrote other books that are abstract, but the subject that he's writing about is not abstract. That's it. He couldn't make it more abstract than the subject demands. You see? So therefore I say there are people that could learn Musa that won't be able to understand Talmud. They won't be able, we would call them wise, and they don't have a good IQ. I mean, there'll be mathematicians and physicists that are more abstract than them, 10 times more, and we will call them wise, because we call wise is a person that lives correctly in this life, that he lives according to reality, not he's just a thinker, you see? So the thing is, what point, the answer to the question, what point, that I can't answer. But however, to say that you need a high IQ, no, I say that you don't need a high IQ. People that would not be able to study math, physics, and Talmud would be able to study Musa. Musa is making decisions in the, making, training how to make decisions in any given situation. Now, the other question is that there's certain people that have very high IQs and they can't relate to Musa. Okay? Or they'll come in and they'll say, no, this is not for me, and they'll walk out. Okay? Now the question is what prevents them from, since they do have the IQ, what prevents them from studying Musa? Now, since Musa deals with life, so now the thing is, let's say for instance, I would tell you the way you're making decisions in life. Let's say you take a 30-year-old person and say, look, the way you've been making decisions in life, all your life, is totally wrong. You have to change the way you make decisions in life. You have to change the way you look at life. Your whole view is totally off. You have to change. How many people are going to be able to say, oh, yeah, he's right. I think I'll spend the next 10 years changing my life around. You know what I mean? How many people are going to do that? So therefore, even though you don't need a high IQ in Musa, the difficulty of Musa is because you have to make a decision that everything I did in the past, or most of the things that I did in the past, or half of the things, whatever it is that is wrong, and now I must make changes in my life. That is not an easy thing. Because then you're going to run against not only an evenly keeled person might be able to do it better. But once you have extremes in your personality and you realize the difficulty of what you're going to have to go through to make changes, people don't want to do that. The question that we have to answer now, what is the righteousness of the evenly keeled or the Tom? Because the righteousness, since he did not get involved in study, so therefore, wherein lies his righteousness? Okay? The answer is that in practical everyday life, since he's evenly keeled, when he thinks, there is no emotion pulling it from one side to the other side. So because of his evenly keeledness, he will be able to analyze a situation and deal correctly. And correctly means he'll sometimes make mistakes because he doesn't have the knowledge, but naturally the evenly keeled person is in everyday life. In other words, he doesn't approach life like we do in a scientific manner, that we sit down to analyze life and discuss it. But naturally, since he's evenly keeled, he doesn't have an emotion pulling him from one side to the other. So therefore, in his everyday practical life, where he has to think through something, he naturally will think correctly in those situations. And therefore, he will deal justly. There was a question, how to cure Lashon Hara. Okay? Now, the first step, that is a lot of steps to curing Lashon Hara. I'm just taking one simple step. Okay? And that is to analyze scientifically the information that comes to you. Okay? The information that comes to you is secondary information. That comes to you through Lashon Hara is secondary information. Okay? Now, the question is, since it's secondary information, there could be two things wrong with secondary information. One is that people lie, or people make mistakes. And by lying, I also mean exaggerate. Okay? Now, you'll notice that nobody ever checks this information out. In other words, they know that the rumor could have occurred through one person starting the rumor, and other people accepted it without question. And they might be the fourth or fifth person down the line, but somehow they still accept it without any question. They accept it. The question is, why is it that they accept it? Right? The answer is that they accept it because there is a need to accept it. There is a need. It's like an addiction that they have to accept it. You see? In other words, to accept the information that they're receiving through the Lashon Hara is satisfying some type of emotion. It's not just the satisfaction, but it's an addiction that they have to satisfy. You see, it's not just, I have a desire. It's an addiction that they have to satisfy, and therefore they refuse to look it over to see if it's any benefit. Like, for instance, a lot of people today gave up on diets. They do not even think about or check what they're eating. They just eat whatever they feel like, because the addiction takes over and they can't think about it. The question is, where do I get this from? Is because there is so simple, just ask a person where he got the information from. Right? You will find that if you constantly ask that question, people will not want to talk to you Lashon Hara. Why is that? Because questioning Lashon Hara means you're stopping the flow. There's a certain desire to accept, and you're questioning it, so therefore you're making me be aware that it might not be true, and therefore my addiction will not be satisfied. And then why don't people analyze it? Why don't people question it? It's a simple question. How did you get the information? On what basis did you give it? Did you get it? Why are you giving it to me? Where did you get it from? Nobody asks that simple question. You're talking about the question is that what about a person that saw the information himself? We're not talking about that. We're talking about the second person who you give it over to. Did he check you out to see that without a doubt you don't make mistakes? You don't lie, you don't exaggerate. You understand? Now, that doesn't mean that you should investigate all Lashon Hara. What the information that people do not investigate show that there is an addiction to Lashon Hara, and therefore people don't care if it's true or not. That should alert you to the fact where that Lashon Hara should not be acceptable. You see? You understand? I'd like to take this one more step. There is a need in the human being to be social. There's nothing wrong. People socialize. But however, where people get together to talk Lashon Hara,
It's not that they are socializing, that they want to socialize and talk Lashon Hara. Since Lashon Hara is an addiction, so I have to say that they're using socializing to satisfy the addiction. In other words, when two people get together, they could get together because there's a human need to be social. And therefore, there's nothing wrong in that. You should socialize, okay? But however, when a person has an addiction, he uses every situation to satisfy his addiction. So therefore, there are people that are getting together, and it looks like they're socializing, but they're only there to satisfy their addiction, but they're not socializing. There's really no camaraderie even. There's no relationship. Each one is just there to satisfy their addiction. Now, I think that this is the first step. We didn't get involved in the what is the psychological makeup of Lashon Hara, but the facts of Lashon Hara show, the facts of Lashon Hara show that it's not, it should not be acceptable to an intelligent person. Zach, that's correct. That when a person analyzes it, if he constantly thinks about this idea, or when he hears Lashon Hara and thinks about the idea of how real it is, how real the Lashon Hara is, after a while it becomes that he starts to realize that this is not real. I mean, people are just have a desire, and especially when you go from person to person, each person has a different emotion of why they want to accept Lashon Hara, so they change the Lashon Hara to fit into their emotion. Since it's an addiction, they're using the information to satisfy their need, and therefore in one form it might not be, and you see when people tell out the Lashon Hara, sometimes it changes a little bit, because there is a need, they have to use the Lashon Hara to satisfy the need, and they might have to change the Lashon Hara a little bit to fit into their needs. In other words, just like a food addiction, there's some people that are meat and potatoes and they overeat that way. Some people are cake, you know what I mean, they're into sweets, and they overeat that way. Some people drink beer and so therefore, in Lashon Hara also, there's different needs, and each person, when they talk, put in their need into the Lashon Hara to satisfy their particular need. The second way of dealing with the information that you get from Lashon Hara is when you get facts, you have the right to interpret it. In other words, sometimes you get information, you get facts, and with the facts you get the interpretation. Okay? You have the right to disagree with the interpretation. Now, all Lashon Hara, to make it really exciting, usually comes with an interpretation. That's what's really satisfying. It's not just the facts. It's the presentation of the facts and the connotations, which is the interpretation of the facts. So therefore, every time you hear Lashon Hara, you have to distinguish. So therefore, all Lashon Hara should be divided between the facts and the interpretations, and to separate between the facts and then give your own interpretation, even if you can accept the facts, then you should. In other words, if somebody says that how terrible a person dresses, you should make up your own mind. You should get the facts of how the person dresses, to make up your own mind if the person dresses good or bad. And we're doing Proverbs chapter 11, verse 6. And it says, the righteous of the Yosher will save them, and the evil of the rebellious ones will destroy them, will capture them. Capture them means their very evil will capture them, will destroy them. Okay?
Okay, so I'm going to explain it according to the Rabbeinu Yonah. Okay? The Yosher is a person that loves truth. He's drawn to the truth, and he searches for truth. Okay? And it says his righteousness, this person, his righteousness will save him. Now the question is, what will it save him from? Because the last verse we said, when we spoke about the Tom, person that's evenly keeled, we said that in an everyday life and practical life, will probably work things out to a certain extent. What he's not involved in is in the world of philosophy, okay? In the world of study and ideas, you know what I mean? But in practical life, since he's evenly keeled, evenly keeled means he doesn't have any emotions pulling him to one direction or another in an extreme way, he probably will be pretty successful in making decisions in everyday life. Okay? But however, the Yosher is the one that is beyond this. He has the evenly keeled, and he is working towards understanding of God. So in what way is his righteousness going to save him? Because insofar as the practical, the evenly keeled person seems to have enough, might make some mistakes here or there because he's not trained in thinking, but he'll naturally think correctly because he's evenly keeled. Okay? So what way are we saying that the Yosher will be saved, and why is it the quality of righteousness that will save him? First of all, we have to tell you that my understanding, where I understand the development of the Yosher, how he develops, okay? When we have these discussions that we have now, we are questioning, a lot of our discussions, we're questioning some of the basic premises which we hold, and we're questioning them, and we're saying that these things, the way I look at life, is incorrect. Okay? And slowly but surely, your whole view of life, suddenly you realize that it becomes totally real to you that your previous life is of no value. Okay? Because as you see all these ideas and the harm and the consequences and conflicts and contradictions in the because of that, the way we live our lives based on our feelings, you see, so suddenly we realize that that whole system of viewing things is incorrect. And what happens is you get, a person falls into a certain type of depression, which is very close to mourning. Like when you lose something very dear, to be a person or a toy for a child. A child loses a toy, they're devastated. It sometimes takes a certain amount of time for them to get over it. That is all part of the definition of mourning. Now here you are losing a part of yourself. And that part of you is who you are, your very self. There can't be a greater pain than that. There's one thinker that wrote a book, and he describes that suddenly for 2 years, like he didn't care if he lived or died, he just continued his life like a robot, you know what I mean? Like he just continued, but the whole thing was taken away from him, like his whole drive was taken away. And then at the end of 2 years, suddenly he started finding enjoyment, but he found his enjoyment in the world of learning. Okay? So that is the first great pain that the Yosher goes through.
because of his desire for truth. And when he searches, he sees that his lifestyle is incorrect and how harmful and destructive it is. So he, and he loses that. He goes through a very, very deep, I don't know if it's depression, because this guy was, it's different than a depression, but it's like mourning. That's the best I can explain. It's like a terrible loss. And that's when the person recognized, that's when the reality of the ideas hit home and they come through, so that whole part of you is lost. That part of you, that desire for the physical, attachment to the physical, is to a certain extent lost, and so therefore you fall into a... Okay, the question that we had is we had... two different examples of flattery. One was lying, where you lie. That was one definition of flattery. And the other was where you keep repeating it many, many times, way beyond that it's necessary. So because of that, we needed a definition of flattery. And we came to two different definitions. Chelsea wanted to say that flattery is only, since the purpose of a compliment is to get the person to act correctly, that's the purpose, to encourage them to act correctly, so therefore, to be a compliment, it must be the correct philosophy. Anytime there is an incorrect philosophy, and even though you mean a compliment, but since it's harm, since the incorrect philosophy and it's a harm to the receiver of the compliment, so therefore we would define that as flattery. That is what Chelsea wanted to say. Okay? Another definition of a compliment is that you must understand the psychological makeup of the person that you're talking to. Because let's say, for instance, the person is in an angry mood, but they're very quiet, they're not expressing their anger, and you compliment them on that, then that could bring out great guilt, and you could do more harm, and they could start acting up because of that. Or for instance, if a person has a bad low self-image, so a compliment might do more damage, you know what I mean? He'll have to break himself to remove the compliment. So the thing is, you must understand the nature of the person to be able to give a correct compliment. That was the harm of flattery, according to the first definition, what the pasuk is saying, the harm of flattery is that they'll be encouraged to do the wrong philosophy. And in the second definition, you will say the wrong thing, which will cause them to react in an adverse way. All right, where... Chapter 11, verse 10. And it says, with the success of the righteous, a city is happy. And with the destruction of the wicked, their song. Okay? The first question is that we don't exactly see this as the truth. I mean, the verse is stating that the city exalts in the good of the righteous. We usually don't find that in many cities, that people are happy with the righteous. Usually they follow the other kind, because the other kind gives vent to their desires and allows freedom to desire. So therefore they follow the other kind, so they'd be happy when the wicked are successful. So the question is, what is the verse talking about? According to Rabbeinu Yonah, it's not that's what the people do, but a person should develop until he actually feels that way. In other words, this is the way you should feel. Okay? A person is drawn, basically his emotions draw him to the pleasures of the physical world. Okay? Now, what happens is that through study and through the ideas, he starts getting a different view
of reality. Okay? Now, when he first gets that different view of reality, he has a conflict. Because one part of him wants the pleasures of the physical world, and one part, the mind, sees the benefit of living the good life. So he's in conflict. But through continually studying, then there is a change where the emotions come in line with the ideas. You see? At that point, he feels emotionally what his mind tells him is truth. And therefore, what the verse is saying, according to Rabbeinu Yonah, is that a person or a city as a whole should develop in the world of ideas and the world of study, where they actually experience the emotion that they attach to the success of the righteous and the failure of the wicked. Right. The next verse is the blessings of the righteous. A city is will be again with the through the blessings of the righteous or the straightforward. A city is has a good foundation or is firm. Okay, and through the mouths of the wicked, it is torn down. By torn down, it means the city will be destroyed. They will destroy the city. Hey, let me get this on. The question is that the that it should be a similar question as before. In other words, that we don't see this in the physical world. Okay, that we don't see it in the physical world. I think before we could ask that question. It's a good question, but I think we have to ask the question: what does it mean, a blessing? The Rabbeinu Yonah has two interpretations. One, the blessing means success, and the other, blessing, it means prayers. He prays for the city. Okay? So let's take one at a time. Let's take success first. In other words, that's correct. In other words, through the blessing or through the success of the righteous, the city will have a firm foundation. Okay? Now the question is, how? I'd also like to ask the question, is how does the wicked destroy the city? So the verse says that the way the wicked destroy the city is through speaking. Now, there are many different types of speaking that could destroy. First of all, you could gossip. For instance, that when they have now a, where we're running for president, and the people that are running speak against the president, and they speak about, like there's nothing he could do right, and then they speak about the people that are running against them, and they're all wrong, right? And they try to bring out all the faults of everybody in the government. Now that somehow, in other words, that would weaken the people in the government. You understand? That would actually weaken them. You see? So therefore, that is one way of the destroying the city. Besides which, they have a certain philosophy of evil. You understand, their philosophy of life could be very destructive. So therefore, it could be through their philosophy of life. Okay? Now, if that is true, the opposite by the righteous could be understood, because then the righteous will teach truth and understanding, the correct philosophy, and through the knowledge, through true knowledge, through true philosophy and the true understanding of reality, is a city firm. That's what makes the city firm. It's that the basis of knowledge and how they make decisions and how they live their life, that is what makes a firm city, or an individual makes him firm, because he sees clearly the right way of living and making decisions. That is the difference between the two. Now the question is, let's learn the verse as a blessing, as a prayer. So the verse says, through the prayers of the upright, a city is made firm, but through the mouth of the wicked, it is torn down. In the first answer, I mean, there's a city in conflict because of the talking about each other, and each one tries to bring the other down. Here, we're dealing with prayer on one side and speaking on the other. So the question is, what does the two have to do with each other? Or what's the subject of the verse, or whatever other questions you might have? In other words, in a city, you don't have to have hundreds of wicked people. You can have one person or a few people in a big, like for instance, in a big firm, that they steal from the firm and take the money for themselves, and like if it has to do with energy or something big, it could affect the whole society. It could affect the stock market. It could affect prices. It could destroy the city in many ways. If you have one of them, imagine if you have fined in 5-6 different areas. I mean, first of all, it brings insecurity to the people, so they stop trusting in anybody in the... which is a very bad thing. If you don't have trust from the people, you can't run a government. And two, these people are ripping down. They're only thinking of themselves. They're ripping apart a government. It doesn't have to be everybody in the... doesn't have to be every citizen. It could be just the evil people. If they're successful, they're going to bring down their government.
So if there's dissent...
Right, the question is that if this is so and you're living in such a place... how would you straighten out such a situation? And I think the verse is telling us that the only way of straightening out the situation is through wisdom. And then wisdom will be a guide for how to... this is all according to the first answer. Right? Wisdom will be a guide help the people... to make correct decisions and how to deal with the people that are in office, or how to deal with the public, with the people in business that are destroying the city, or with the wrong people with the wrong philosophies and gossiping and all these things. The wisdom will guide you how to deal with it. Okay? The thing is that, see, that's what the verse is saying, that if the wicked are successful and the righteous aren't, you see, then that will destroy the city. If the righteous become successful, then they'll educate the public and the people will live a just and righteous life. The question is, when we say these people talk or cheat, in other words, is this evil? In other words, what is evil? There are two parts to Torah. We always said there's that legal part, and then there's the hashkafa, or loosely translated, our philosophy. Okay? Now, insofar as law is concerned, it's very clear what is evil and what is not. But insofar as philosophy is concerned, we point out the consequences or results of living the righteous life and living the evil life, or living the life of the wise, or living the life of the fools. Okay? That's all of Proverbs. That's what it's about. It shows you the consequences, and that's what makes a person change when he sees the harm. In other words, a lot of people are good because, well, I'm a religious man, so I'm good. That is not a wise person. A wise person is a person that sees and understands the consequences of the of his actions. And so therefore, when you say evil, you have to be careful. Yes, it is evil to do these things,
But our subject is not defining evil. That would be more legally we would define it. But what are the consequences of living an evil or foolish life? I'd like to bring a proof to this idea. It says in Psalms 92, it says in verse 7, it says, a foolish man, bar is like an animal, call him like an animal. An animal doesn't understand, and a foolish man doesn't understand this. He repeats it. And then he says what he doesn't understand in the next verse. He says, when the wicked flourish like grass, and they spread out, and all their evil actions, it's to be destroyed forever. They are successful. Their success leads to destruction. So the question is, who is the wicked person and who is the fool here? Okay? So the fool is a person that accepts the ideas of Torah and accept that it's wicked to not to do certain things, but they don't understand why. On the contrary, they might be jealous of the success of the wicked. They're really it's jealous. Why is that guy so successful? You understand? He's such a wicked guy. He's a cheat. Well, you know? It bothers them. While he says they don't, what they don't understand is that the success of the wicked, that's the beginning of their downfall. That is a symptom of their downfall, their success. Okay? Now the question is, how does it work that the success of the wicked is their downfall? Okay? A simple proof of this is you look at all the most successful nations, at the height of their success is when they failed. Okay? They always were toppled down at the height of their success. Okay? They're always brought down. The question is why? Why is success such a destructive thing? You see? The answer is, Doug is right, that the answer is that the that as a person is successful in his evil ways, so he thinks that that is the correct way of operating, and he puts more emphasis on it and relies on it more than before. And two, his nature, person is not static. A person goes far from logic as he's more successful and he relies more on his evil ways. His ego becomes very great and he doesn't rely on logic as much as he did before. He relies more on his own feelings because he sees that that was successful, you see. Like, for instance, Hitler, we find, first of all, the Blitzkrieg was very successful. But however, when he went into Russia, he was so spread out that they closed them off, because the Blitzkrieg also, there's a certain amount that it's good, and in certain situations it's good, but you have to know how far and in what situations. Because it was successful, he just relied on it all the time, and he never thought anything. He just thought all you have to do is just charge through and you win the war. But he didn't realize he had to bring up replacements, reinforcements, and there was a big gap between the Blitzkrieg and the people that were bringing in the reinforcements, and that's where the Russians filled in the gap right in there, and thousands of troops were killed at that time. So you see that when you rely on a certain method of operation, it doesn't work 100% in every situation. You have to know when and where and how much of it to do. But they put their total reliance on certain areas of success. Same thing happened with Ford. He had this car that was for the everyday people. So it was a very, very cheap car. And but later on, people in America wanted fancier cars, and he refused to change because that was the successful method of doing it. And he would have failed. I mean, the whole company would have gone down except somebody else took over. Whatever it was, I don't remember the exact details. But the fact is that he himself, the original Ford, which was a good idea when he started, But he could not change. He just kept going in that way, in that direction. You see? So success of the evil person or success of a foolish person that's driven by success, they have certain patterns which they interpret as successful. And they don't realize that it could work in certain situations, and sometimes you have to change for different situations. So therefore, the success firms up their commitment to their stupid ways or their stupid patterns in which they operate until they can't get out of it, and therefore they destroy themselves. Right, we're up to the second interpretation of prayer. Okay, how does prayer work? Okay, we live in two worlds. We live in the world of the laws of nature, and we live in God's personal supervision. Okay, now it is possible that sometimes the city doesn't deserve to exist, but because of the prayers of the righteous, they fall under God's personal supervision, and God can protect the city despite the fact that they're not on the level to be protected because of the level of the righteous. And like we said before, it is possible that God would allow the city to exist as long as you have such righteous people, because then there's a chance that the people can change their patterns of evil based on ideas, and therefore they could come back to the world of truth. So as long as you have these righteous people that are there to pray to God and to guide the people, so then there is a then they could come under God's personal supervision, where God would protect them and not allow them to be destroyed, on the chance that they will repent and change their patterns of evil to go to a life of truth. We're discussing the idea that there's a certain point where a person can't repent, and that's within the laws of nature that they can't change the way they are. We'd like to clarify that idea. Okay? It seems to be Nineveh was that way, where God told Jonah that in 3 days, if he doesn't help them repent, then they'll never be able to repent, which means they're going to reach a certain point where they can't repent. Okay? We'd like to understand the nature of that idea where you cannot repent. Okay. A personality, when a person is born with a personality, it's a certain pattern of operation. Okay? That pattern of operation is his personality. And therefore, when you meet people and they act in a certain way, you always know what to expect because you know the patterns of their personality and how they react to different situations. Okay? Now, you will notice through knowledge, through chachma and wisdom, people have the ability to change. Okay? Repentance means that my knowledge tells me that I shouldn't live according to these patterns. Or certain times I could live according to the pattern, certain times I shouldn't, so that I should live when I shouldn't live according to patterns, so the mind tells me that I should go against the pattern. Okay? That is repentance. Okay? Now, as you make decisions based on these patterns, the patterns become more firm. And once they become so firm that ideas cannot affect them. That was why, in other words, you see that from the two societies. There was the society of the flood and the society of the towers. Now, the society of the tower was more evil than the society of the flood. But the thing is, the people of the flood, okay, the people of the flood were involved in pleasures and immediate satisfaction. In other words, they started... I'd like to go... We're doing Proverbs, chapter 11, verses 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. It's an interesting thing that verse 10 and 11 is talking about the city or community or state. Then verse 14 also talks about a nation. But the two verses in between, in other words, verses 12 and 13, one is talking about if you shame your friend, is a fool, right? And then it says about talking gossip, about gossiping and revealing secrets. Okay? Because when you gossip, you reveal, you carry secrets over from one place to another. Right? So the question is, if he's talking about the government, how to run a government, or what benefits a government, so why didn't he put verse 14 right after 11 and keep them together? Why did he put in between these two verses? That's the question. We're going to go over yesterday's question, and that is that verses 10 and 11, verses 10 and 11 deal with the city, and then it goes to an individual. 12 and 13 deal with individuals, and then 14 goes to the city. And the question was, why did he go in that order? Why didn't he keep the city, all the city ideas together? So we wanted to say and that is two ways of destroying a city or a country, and that is from within it's weakened and destroyed, or a more powerful country comes and destroys it. We're talking about where it's destroyed from within, not from without. Okay, what destroys a country, a nation, a community from within? Okay? Now, what keeps a society strong is where they are cohesive and unified together. And there are two things that undo this cohesiveness, and that is where a person does not have respect for another person, will put him down and shame him and embarrass him, or two, where secrets are not kept and you can't trust anybody. So therefore, where the community has violated these two actions against their fellow citizens, that is going to bring the destruction of a city from within, because it removes the cohesiveness of the group. Chapter 24, verse 16 in Mishle, it says that seven times the righteous will fall and he'll rise up, and the wicked, when he stumbles, in other words, he won't get up anymore. He will be destroyed. Okay? That is what the pasuk says. The first question is, what does it mean he falls down? What does that mean? And whatever it means, why is he able to rise up seven times while the wicked cannot rise up at all? They fall, they can't rise up. Okay? And the word seven doesn't literally mean seven. The word seven just means a lot of times. It could be two times, it could be 50 times. Okay? How many times he falls, he rises up. And then we'll deal with the Russia first, okay? We'll deal first with the Russia, okay? The Russia, you have to be careful. We have to make a distinction between a Russia, a wicked person, and mediocrity. There's a Russia and a tzaddik have something in common. They're both committed to a certain lifestyle, and they put all their energy into that lifestyle. Mediocrity is not committed. They have a little work, they come home, they might watch TV, they'll drop by a bar or something, you know. Like, they have many different things. They enjoy their family, they enjoy their TV, They enjoy a party. There's many different things that they enjoy. They're not committed to one thing. The wicked person depends the nature of the wicked person. Like, for instance, Hitler was committed to doing evil. He wanted to control the planet, and he wanted to wipe out every Jew that existed. And he was committed to this. On the other hand, Elvis Presley was committed to the life of pleasure. A total life of pleasure. He was committed to that. There was nothing else that was important. There was a man by the name of Hemingway who was also committed to the life of pleasure. And then when he got older and he couldn't enjoy the pleasures as much as in his youth, so he committed suicide because he was committed to the life of pleasure. And once he couldn't have it, so then why bother living? Okay? So an evil person is a person who's committed to a certain area of pleasure or desire, while the tzaddik is committed to the world of Torah and study. Okay? So that's what the tzaddik and the wicked have in common. When we're talking about the wicked, we are not talking about mediocrity in this case. Because if mediocrity fails in one area, they will go into a different area. Now, when you're committed to something, totally committed, and suddenly you realize you can't have it, then you will totally break. You will totally crack. You find that by Hitler. Later on, you find that by Elvis, he needed to make money, so he had uppers to get on the stage, and then when he got off the stage, he had downers, put him back to sleep again. The thing is that once that which you committed your total life to, that once you recognize that you cannot have it, then it's totally over. Then it's gone, you see? And that's the time where the person is totally broken and there's absolutely nothing else that there is. And therefore, these people, when they crack, they do not get up anymore. They're totally destroyed. An observation by Aaron that the drugs is not there for the enjoyment. Maybe when a person starts drugs, he thinks it's enjoyable. But drugs is usually a means of escape or to get away, like to put him to sleep, like by an Elvis's case, like to put him to sleep. Or he needed uppers to get on the stage to be able to sing. Again, the drugs are only a means of escape once the life is so painful that he can't, because he can't maintain that which he is committed to, that he got every ounce of energy involved into, so then he needs an escape, and then he uses drugs only as an escape. Now, the question is, what about the tzaddik? What the tzaddik is committed to is a search for truth and reality, and then try to live in line with that reality. That reality is never really destroyed. But, however, there are sometimes very powerful emotions that will affect his life. Okay? Like, for instance, we find that by Yaakov, he had a strong emotion about his son Yosef. And because of that, the Torah tells us that he bought him a jacket of many colors. That was to show his attachment to, that was an example of his attachment to Yosef. Now, the thing is, when Yosef was separated from him for 22 years, so our sages say that during those 22 years he was very depressed, and that because of his depression he couldn't get nevuah. Nevuah, you can't get nevuah, prophecy, when you're depressed. You have to get it in a situation of calm and happiness, but not depression. And he didn't get the prophecy for 22 years. So the thing is that in his depression, the question is, what kept him going? what kept him going for 22 years, despite the fact that he was in a situation of depression? The answer is that as you study Torah and you start investigating reality, and you also investigate your emotions, so then you recognize that when you're in pain, that the only way out of the emotional pain is through an investigation. In other words, most people that do not know this when they're in pain, so they turn away from the pain and put their energy into either they escape, like we showed by Elvis, or they put their energy into something else, like by mediocrity. If a catastrophe happens, they'll put their energy into one of the other things that they're involved in. But to the tzaddik, the only way out of the psychological pain is to deal with it directly. And that's how he trained himself all his life. In his search for truth, he recognized that he has to deal with the emotions that affect his thinking process and that that cause him to make mistakes. Now, Yaakov, in his depression, had to recognize that his depression was caused by Yosef and that he couldn't get out of it. He must have had to deal with it. But sometimes an emotion is so deep, like you see in Yaakov's case, it took 22 years for him to deal with it. That is the difference between the Rasha and the Tzaddik. They're both committed, but one is committed to something that is not real and cannot last. And therefore, that commitment at a certain point will break down and will totally destroy you. The commitment to reality will never break down. What will happen is certain emotions will affect him and hurt him and depress him, but because of his training, he will train to deal with it. That's what it means when he falls down, he will get up again. No matter how many times he fails, he will get up again and continue the investigation. The question is, why is it that powerful religious emotions lead to extremes in certain actions, and what's there about the religious emotion that leads to these extremes? Okay? Now, the thing is that you have to understand where the religious emotion comes from. There is a certain insecurity in the physical world, and because of that, it's like, for instance, I mean, you have a tennis ball, hits you in the temple in the right place, it could kill you or give you brain damage. You understand? There's small little things. I mean, a little thing could knock your eye out. You know, I mean, the physical world is a very insecure world. And so therefore, what people do is they create a power to protect them and so that they do not have to face this reality. Okay? Now, when the reality starts breaking through, every time reality starts, tries to show them that the world is insecure, so they have to move stronger to their religious attachment to remove that recognition of reality and that insecurity that reality actually gives. You understand? So therefore, because of that, they keep going to more and more extremes that, for instance, today we have people that are willing to commit suicide, you know, to kill the enemy because they know and it's so real to them that they will have a better life after they die and they'll enjoy the physical world after they die more than during their lifetime. So they go to extremes to protect themselves from all types of to protect themselves from reality, because reality doesn't seem to point to what the way they think.
Okay, we're in Proverbs chapter 11, verse 16, and Rashi has two different interpretations. We'll take both interpretations.
okay? The first one is, it is a, there will be destruction, a harm will come to you if you pledge your heart to idolatry. Zor over here means idolatry. Zor literally means a foreigner, but over here means foreign idolatry. And those that hate clapping will be secure. Okay? Question is, what does it mean, clapping? Rashi says that clapping represents that they used to clap at the functions. You know what I mean? I assume by there was music or working together, like a, or a music type of thing, a beat, you understand, that would get the people going. That's what it seems to be from Rashi. Those are the facts of the pasuk, according to the first explanation. Okay, the pasuk is talking about the destruction of a person that worships idolatry. It leads to a certain type of destruction. But the second half is saying what brings you to idolatry. Okay? There's certain, in other words, when you come to a certain situation, you're drawn to the this idea of clapping. In other words, if you hate the thing that draws you, then you'll be protected. Okay? But if you enjoy that thing which draws you into idolatry, then you will, then the odds are you will fail. And you will fall into idolatry. It's the beginning steps. It's the beginning steps that is the destruction. That's why he says that if you pledge your heart to idolatry, that'll be destructive. Whatever the destruction of idolatry is, okay? But the second half of the verse is saying what will protect you is if you hate that which draws you to religion. Insofar as, like, let's say, for instance, Christmas, right? So what draws people to that aspect is the presents. Because people feel they get something, so, you know, first of all, they feel good, and second of all, they feel like God loves them because they're getting something, they're just getting what they want, so they feel that God loves them. Okay, so the question is that they want to say that it's not Jesus that people see on Christmas, but it's Santa Claus. Okay? And even Santa Claus represents a mystical, magical thing. And insofar as the feeling in the unconscious is that there's some power that has bestowed some good upon them. In other words, you could start out that way, but there's a certain feeling of that something bestowed a good on me, some authority. Now, the authority is usually God. I mean, that's in the unconscious, that's what it's going to be. So therefore, even if you tell me Santa Claus, so then I say, yeah, then Santa Claus is equal to the clapping of the hands. That's what draws you to. That would be the beginning where I just want, I'm not really interested in religion. I'm just interested in Christmas because there's a nice feeling. There's presence. You understand? The night atmosphere, right. See, right. Those type of things is the clapping. Because deep down behind it, everybody knows that Christmas represents Jesus. And it has to be there. The unconscious cannot, it recognizes this. And that becomes the first step towards moving into the world of idolatry. In other words, there are three possibilities we have here. We either have that you relate to Jesus for Christmas, you relate to Santa Claus, or there's a certain nice atmosphere. Now, if it's Jesus, so then that's idolatry already. If it's Santa Claus, so then it's a fantasy, which is leading to idolatry. And if it's a good feeling, that's definitely equal to the clapping, where there's a certain good feeling about the holiday, so therefore it draws you into what the holiday represents. The same thing with certain people mentioned here, that they enjoy the shopping that goes with Christmas, and they enjoy the lights and the music. The thing is that the unconscious is going to be drawn to the source of this type of pleasure. In other words, insofar as the unconscious is concerned, it will be drawn to the source. It recognizes that the source of this pleasure is Christianity and Jesus, and it recognizes that that's what draws you. And there's a certain feeling that this holiday brings good feeling and good cheer and all these things, and so therefore, definitely in the unconscious, it is there. On Tuesday, we said that that when something gives you pleasure, you're drawn to the object which causes that pleasure, and therefore you have to be very careful about things that draw you to evil things or in idolatry in particular. Okay? Aaron asked the question that basically, how could you live in this world? I mean, because wherever you turn, there's advertisements, there's different pleasures, there's all around you. In every area are things that are giving you pleasure or drawing you unconsciously to a certain direction. And the question is, how could you live in this world? In Torah, there are two things. There's halacha, and there is hashkafa, or philosophy. Loosely translated, philosophy. The word hashkafa comes from a viewpoint, where you change your view of life. That's really what hashkafa is. Where the training, where you have a certain view of life, and there's a certain training to change your view of life.
What's your view of life?
Insofar as halacha is concerned, whether I understand it or whether I don't understand it, I must do the act. There's an act that I'm obligated to do, and whether even if I don't understand why God made this or why it's a good act, even the Rambam in his Moreh Nevuchah mentions a couple of cases in halacha, which he doesn't understand the philosophy behind it. Okay? So, but you have to keep the halacha. Insofar as hashkafa, your view of life, you cannot change, it's impossible to change your view of life unless you understand it, unless your mind sees it. You can't accept something that your own mind doesn't see. It's impossible. So therefore, insofar as the world of hashkafa is concerned, a person has to develop, in other words, as he develops, he changes his view and he recognizes things in his development. Okay? So therefore, insofar as you recognize the truth, then despite the fact that there are subliminal information coming along your way that is affecting you, if you're on a level, then you would recognize this and be able to, it would not affect you, because if it goes through the conscious mind, it's not going to affect you. So then you could deal with it. If it's an unconscious thing, then you can't deal with it only as you develop. It's not like halacha that you're obligated to do the act. As soon as you know what the correct act is to do, you do the act. Here, even if you know the correct philosophy or the truth, you might not be ready to carry it out, and it takes a certain amount of time to become part of your view of life, which means your view of life has totally changed. So then you can see the truth and live according to that truth. The question is about the Christmas in general. Let's say I don't see how Christmas is affecting me. I don't understand it. question is halacha, what you're allowed to receive, what you're allowed to do for with that applies to Christmas, what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. There's an office party that really is just a party that has nothing to do with Christmas. That would be a question of halacha, whether you're allowed to go there. That would not be under the category of hashkafa. Right, the question is how come our sages have a right to change the law like they made chicken into meat? According to the Torah, chicken is equal to fish. Okay? But our sages changed it and made it into meat. Okay? How could they change God's law? Okay? The answer is that when God created the system, God created a perfect system which he gave over to Moshe. Okay? But however, he gave it over to the humans, he gave over the responsibility to the human being to maintain this system. Okay? And therefore, within the system, they must always prove from the system where they have a right to change, to make a new law or change laws. In other words, the system itself is such a system that in certain situations you can't change the law. But that must be proven from the original system which God gave in on Mount Sinai. So it's all within the system that that they have the right to change the laws. The question is why didn't God change it in the first place? Why didn't God make that the law if he wanted that to be the law? The answer is, again, first of all, we have the responsibility. God wanted us to take responsibility when to change the law and when not to change the law. Okay? Now, the thing is, God made a perfect system. The situation where the rabbis, the sages, have a right to change the law, you see, is where human beings they see that the human beings cannot maintain it in its perfect system, so protect them from failure, they had to stretch the law, and, like, for instance, over here, people were seeing that you could eat chicken, in the minds of the society, chicken and meat were pretty similar. And therefore, if they saw people eating a chicken burger with cheese on it, you see, so they would assume, oh, then I'm allowed to eat together. You understand, meat and milk. They would make terrible, the sages saw that they were making terrible mistakes. So when they saw they were making, the human being was making mistakes, that is when they intervened to protect them. And they had the right from the system itself. But God did not make it before the human beings needed it. He created a perfect system. If there were human beings, would never make mistakes. But since he knew they would make mistakes, so he gave the sages, or there'd be different situations, so he gave the sages the right to change the laws to protect them so that they should be able to keep the laws perfectly. In other words, God does not make decisions based on prophecy on the future. He makes decisions based on the now. Right now, I'm giving you a perfect system. Okay? So therefore, when people make mistakes, the sages have the right to protect the system. Okay? Even where there's a machlokas, I'll tell you, there's a machlokas. God, machlokas means a difference of opinion. God definitely only said one over the other, and we can be making a decision like the other person. So you see, again, in that case also, we have the responsibility to maintain the system as human beings. We are not angels. We're human beings, and we can make a decision. We can make mistakes. And in other words, we might be making a decision different than what God said on Mount Sinai. We have the right to extend the law based on the situation. We have the responsibility to maintain the system which God gave on Mount Sinai. Then he gave it over to the human being. It's our responsibility to maintain it. Not only that, if Moshe came down now and says, we're doing differently than what he said, we're not allowed to listen to him. You'd be violating halacha if you listen to him. Because we live by a system, not by prophecy. Moshe could only tell me prophecy. The prophecy of the law is only the first time when God gave it over to Moshe on Mount Sinai. After that, prophecy does not affect the law, except in certain rare cases where the law says that prophecy works for certain reasons. Well, in other words, a lot of people have a view of God that I have to know exactly what God says and I can't make any mistakes. No, God gave us this system, the perfect system, and now we're responsible to maintain it, but we have to maintain it as human beings. We can't maintain it. Religion likes to be perfect. What I say is 100% perfect. Nothing is wrong. That's not our religion. Our religion has a system that the human being has to maintain as a human being. And the sages have the right to change laws, or if they are down on what the law, so then we make a decision based on one of these people, even if God didn't say it. I mean,